over the place, obviously. Managed to get John Burt's secretary. She said he'd ring back, which he did pretty quickly. Frankly, whatever else they say about him, he's always been an absolute poppy to me. Spoke to Carla, and she invited me to a black tie dinner she's holding in honour of Colin Powell, the US Chief of Staff during the Gulf War. She's a firm friend and is inviting just about everyone in the world, so I'm rather honoured. What a couple. She told me an extraordinary thing. Paul Johnson, whom I've only met twice, and on both occasions he has been rather scowly, and Carla were in their Catholic church this morning. Carla to pray for Nicky, her son, who's having a brain scan. Too much bonking, darling. I know it. He's my beautiful son, but he does bonk too many girls. And Paul, because he's always in there, apparently. Paul said that his wife Marigold, who was with him at the Such's lunch on Sunday, is a great fan of mine and would love to get to know me better. Paul, on the other hand, when Carla told him that she liked me too, growled, "But he's a socialist, isn't he?" To which Carla promptly replied, "But so were you, darling, when you were his age." Paul then agreed and said that they should pray for my deliverance from socialism. So, Carla and Paul Johnson get down in a Catholic church in London and pray for me to be converted to conservatism. Most peculiar. Carla was howling with laughter as she told me. Well, she's Italian and has a splendid attitude to everything. Dear me, however. Anyway, she thought Charles would be delighted to write a reference for me. He's a busy man, however, so I might get a backup reference from Max Hastings. Managed to write a small sketch. Hugh was away all day on a recce for his commercial. Then I turned to the copy-edited version of the Hippo. This has to be in today in order to get the thing fully done in time for proof copies to be out in December. The copy editor, Hugo de Clay, splendid name, has done an excellent job, I think. Somewhat pernickety about the shooting scene, but very attentive. So I spent 3 or 4 hours going through that and reminding myself of it. 6 o'clock, and off to the Savoy to meet Kim before the first night of Eurovision. Footnote, a stage musical, not the peculiar television event. We sat and supped old fashions, said hi to Neil Tennant and Julian Lloyd Webber and others who were there, then toddled to the theatre. Joe in attendance waiting for Hugh, whom she hadn't seen all day. He fetched up at last, having forgotten all about it, and only realised when he had got home and found Melissa, their nanny, babysitting. The show was about the campest thing you could ever imagine. In fact, not very good. Made tolerable only by one astonishing performance from an actor called Julian Dreyfus. Footnote. I meant James Dreyfus, unless he subsequently changed his name, later to achieve fame in the immortal Gimme Gimme Gimme. End footnote. One to watch without question. The whole drama was incredibly amateurish and lumpen in structure. Some excellent farce scenes involving, of all things, the ghosts of Hadrian and Antinous, but somehow it was all a bit stupid. It won't appeal that much to gay audiences because they will have seen it all before at Madame Jojo's and a million nightclubs and gay theatre happenings up and down the country. The person in our party who enjoyed it most, as it happens, was Jo Laurie. She didn't like it when it started going on about love in the second act, however. The Ivy afterwards for dins. I coked up in the loo, which I have no doubt Hugh and Jo noticed. Oh dear, I am an arse. I expect there'll be what I believe is called an intervention soon. I keep picturing it, all my friends bearing down on me and me denying everything until my pockets are emptied. Oh, the shame. Lots of wine and coffee, and home by 1:45. Then, stupidly sat and gazed at the TV while doing the crossword and chopping more lines. Bed by 2:30. Stupid, 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 stupid. Thursday, the 11th of November, 1993. Poppy Day, 75th anniversary thereof. A day for sitting at home and working. Bad news popped in. The legal secretary of TVS, who owned the lease on the set in Albany, rang up to say that there was a first-comer who has now definitely expressed an interest, and she feels duty-bound to give him first crack of the whip. Pooh. I've amassed a startling collection of references, however, one from Sir Charles Powell, one from John Burt, and one from Max Hastings, all very splendid. Charles begins his with the typically but lovably pompous, "Gentlemen?" Hey-ho. Unless this chap pulls out at the last moment or can't get the right references, it looks as though I shall have to wait more. The car came at seven-ish to take me to the studios for a Clive Anderson Talks Back. Bamber Gascoigne was another guest, plus a chap who gives, and is a walking example of, body piercing. He had studs in his tongue, a massive spike through his septum, one through his lower lip, nipple rings, and though this was never shown, a Prince Albert. Crumbs. I think I was all right. A very startling reception from the audience, who appeared to be delighted to see me. Much whooping and cheering, very gratifying, but I should imagine intensely irritating to the TV audience. Spoke a bit about the horse scene in The Hippo and about politics. Did my family values stuff. Rather hard-hitting, but well-received from the audience. Shifted it from the London studios to the Groucho for a poker game. Griff and Bob Ringo and an actress called Caroline. She was very sweet, but introduced a game called Anaconda, which all but wiped me out. First time I've lost that heavily for years. That'll teach me. Much of cocaine. Bed at 2. Friday the 12th of November 1993. Up very early for a voiceover. It was in Oxford Street, so I shopped at M&S afterwards. Back for Hugh, some sketch writing and normal business, and then I popped at 7 round to Quaglino's for dinner with Alfredo, footnote, Alfredo Fernandino, co-founder of Two Bridges Place, a members' club in the almost unbelievably narrow passageway next to the Coliseum Theatre in London's St. Martin's Lane. From a powerful Peruvian family, he introduced Perudo to Britain and marketed it with his friend Cosmo Fry, end footnote. Also there was Patrick Kinmonth, an old school chum, whom I've only seen twice in the last 20 years. He's a splendour, however. Painter and now theatre designer. Very talented, very sweet. Had a good dinner, courtesy of Patrick, who has Quag's luncheon vouchers, part payment for decorating one of the pillars in the main dining area. Back to my place for chat. I disappeared into the loo every 10 minutes, but they didn't seem to notice, and popped off at 3. I knew it was okay, because for the first time in ages, I could sleep in on Saturday as much as I liked. Saturday, 13th of November, 1993. Awoke at 12:20, feeling much refreshed. Went out and bought some videos at Tower Records, shopped a little at Fortnum's, and then came back to eat and watch telly. Bliss. First time in ages. At 6:30, off to the lorries for Dins. Kim and Al and Nick and Sarah. Good fun. I eschewed coking up in their loo. I know they know, and I know it upsets them. Home at 1:30. Sunday the 14th of November, 1993. A very busy day spent completing the Spectator diary for next week and writing the speech for the film premiere on Tuesday. Eventually got it all done and then watched a bit of telly before packing and cabbing it to Euston Station for the sleeper to Dundee. Footnote. I was rector of Dundee University. By this time, I think I was partway through my second 3-year tenure. The honorary post, unique to the ancient Scottish universities, involves looking after the interests of the students who vote for their rector. I would come up by train to attend meetings of the university court and hold surgeries. End footnote. Drank a bit of scotch and ate a couple of sandwiches. Huge mistake. For some reason, it gave me the horriblest pangs of indigestion you can imagine. Bloody nuisance. Acid gnawing inside me and the train hammering through the night. Very little sleep. Monday, the 15th of November, 1993. Next stop, Dundee Station at 6:05. Absolutely bloody freezing on the platform, and the train was 10 minutes early, so I had to hang around until my welcoming party arrived to take me off to breakfast. The welcoming party consisted of Jim Duncan, the rector's assessor, Aisha, the president of the Students' Association, DUSA, Deucer, and Dougie, the senior vice president. Amiable people. Aisha is actually rather stylish and splendid, the best of the three I've known so far. I'm sure she could walk into any job as a researcher for Clive Anderson, Jay Ross, that kind of thing. Sweet and bubbly, not a fool either. Back to Jim's house, as is traditional, to consume a large breakfast cooked by his dear wife Hilda. Lots of orange juice, black pudding, bacon and so forth. Then there was the usual hour or so of sitting and chatting, catching up with whatever issues are prevalent in the university. None really at the moment, thank God, before our first visit. I've instituted this custom whereby I'm shown round a couple of different departments of the university every court day. Bit Prince of Walesy, but they all seem to like it, and I find it absolutely fascinating. Actually, we stopped off at Aisha's digs on the way because she had promised her flatmate that I would pop round. They were still in bed, as it happened, a couple, blonde and gorgeous and tousled and studenty, so sweet. Had a coffee while they de-grogged. First port of call was the Accountancy and Business School. Not very exciting, you might think, but Bob Lyon, the department head, was amiable, and so were all the staff. Met a gang of absurdly UN international graduates from Sri Lanka, Saudi, Bangladesh, that sort of thing. The computer whiz, a splendid, hairy-faced wonderment called Roz, showed me the computers, and we did some internetting, trying to chase a Douglas Adams thread. Coffee in the staff room and more chatting before we slid over to the School of Politics and Social Policy. Very amiable bunch of people, nothing actually to see there, unlike visits on previous occasions to other departments where one can goggle at medical equipment, labs and so forth, but nonetheless a charming group of people. Rather left-leaning, which is rare for Dundee. Charles Kennedy and George Robertson, both products of that school, I believe. They weighed me down with books and pamphlets. Midday now, and time to visit the principal, Michael Hamlin. Not looking too good. Bit of fluid retention under the chin and puffiness about the eyes. Not a well man, I fancy. He's retiring at the end of the year. We chatted for 3/4 of an hour, he calling me Simon, as usual. Time for the pre-court lunch. Sat next to a bit of an ass, can't remember his name. Usual rubber chicken and split mayonnaise. Bless them. Then at 2, couldn't be put off any longer, time for court. I dropped off 3 times. The first time, Jim Duncan, by my side, woke me up. The next 2 times, I was awoken by a change of voice or something else. There really is nothing on earth so arse-paralysingly drear as a committee of academics discussing university business. The only time I really perked up was to repudiate a letter written by an oncologist asking how the university could morally justify the setting aside of smoking rooms to feed student addictions. Please. The court wound up in record time after 2 hours, and I had an hour to kill before my appointment at 5 to address the freshers. We went to Pete's Bar, upstairs in the Association building, and drank some scotch. Lots of studes clustering around, all very charming. Then, at 5, in I went to the Dead Club, where hundreds of little freshers had assembled to hear their rector speak. I'd only been told this was to happen this morning, so no chance to prepare, all busked, therefore. I told them that there was nothing on earth less appealing than a young person putting on a hard, cynical face and trying to look as if they saw through everything and knew the world for what it was. I told them it was their duty every morning to check their faces in the mirror and to make sure that they looked lovely and open and kind and smiley. A full hour of talking. Think it went all right. Then another hour in the bar before the dinner that had sweetly been laid on in my honour by the students themselves. They had drawn lots to see who could attend, because they wanted to keep the numbers manageable. As always, there seemed to be some deep desire amongst the corpus studenti to get me completely hammered. It was my job to circulate around the table so that I sat with every group for a fair length of time. They were all very sweet, actually, and welcoming. At last, tottering and with the help of a couple of lines in the bog, I was escorted by Jim and Dougie, Aisha being off her face by this time, to the station. Another huge whiskey, and then the train pulled in. We're talking 10:55 p.m. by this time. Managed to sleep straight away, which, despite the lines, both railway and stimulant, is something of a miracle. Tuesday, 16th of November, 1993. Woke up in Euston at 7. Cab to St. James's and bed for 2 hours before struggling up again for a voiceover. What a business. Got back at 11, time for opening post and a cup of coffee before a cab to Whitfield Street for a 4-hour photography session for the Hippo cover and publicity materials. Not too bad. Charming snapper called Colin Thomas and Mark McCollum and Sue Freestone were present, all old chums. Footnote, PR and editor respectively at Heinemann, publishers of the Hippo. End footnote. Tried various poses, emerging from a bath with suds, that kind of thing. Hope it isn't all too vulgar. The book is not entirely of that nature, after all. At least, I don't think it is. Left at 3:30-ish, me desperate to get back to the flat and prepare my speech. In the cab back to St. James's, I realise I've left my coat at the studio. It contains my keys. Arse. I borrow the wonderful local barber's phone and we ask Colin T to shove it all in a cab instanter. Sue and Mark and self then repair to the Red Lion pub for a half of Guinness and so forth. Cab turns up, I'm back in business. The speech is all right, I think. I don't have time to learn it, however, so I'll read. Not ideal, but suck it. At 6:45-ish, Alice Faye turns up looking absolutely stunning in a Starzewski frock of limitless elegance and beauty. We have a gin and tonic and then pop in the car for the Odeon Leicester Square. Big crowds, natch. We are welcomed by a very charming old biddy called Shirley, who takes me and Alice Faye round backstage. A lot of pacing about behind the screen from me as the trumpeter heralds warm up their instruments and the screen in front of us shows the celebs and eventually the royal party arriving. After the fanfare and national anthem, I go out on stage and make my speech of welcome. Talk about the Cinema and Television Benevolent Fund and their work. Seems to go well. Then, escorted round to my seat in the Royal Box for the film itself, which I have to say I liked a great deal. Very written, but none the poorer for that. Intelligent and humane for the most part, and containing quite simply the best child performance I've ever seen. Really a brilliant boy called Nick Stahl. Quite remarkable, as good as Jodie Foster in Taxi Driver. Mel Gibson, too, a fine performance and well directed. Not a big film, or a possible cult film, but a good film, to be proud of. As soon as it was over, I was whisked downstairs to meet the POW. He was very matey and said to me, "You did write that speech, didn't you?" I said, "Indeed I did, sir." He said, "Mel Gibson asked me if you'd written it yourself," and I said indignantly, "Of course he did." Introduced him to Alice Faye, and they chatted a bit about Cleese and Frankenstein. We got in the car after HRH had gone and went all the way to Planet Hollywood, where the party was, stayed for a voddy, and then to the Ivy for dins. Parties are so ghastly at Planet H, really. Nice dinner, in fact. Chatted for a while. Alice Faye said that she and John thought my short writings were better than my novels. I was very stung by this. I sensed that The Liar was just the sort of thing that Cleese would not like because, despite, or perhaps because of, his comic genius, he does not seem to understand the profound truth that comic things are more serious than serious things. More serious and truer. It's part of his guilt at being a comedian and reflected in his absurdly high doctrine of abstract spiritualist writing like the Tibetan Book of the Dead, Gurdjieff, Coelho and that kind of bogus baloney. If you'd ever read a true mystic like the author of The Cloud or Mother Julian, he would know that abstraction and unearthed thinking are foreign to true spirituality. I tried to get some of this across. I don't know if she understood. Annoyed with myself for being so stung, however. Bed late-ish. Wednesday, the 17th of November, 1993. What a strange day. It began early. Horribly early. It began with the big breakfast for Channel 4. I had agreed that I would go on to help plug Perudo. Cosmo Fry had asked, and I, softy that I am, had consented. Felt a bit grumpy on the way to, God rot it, Bow. I knew that when it was over, I would have to charge off in another car to go all the way over to Wandsworth for another sitting with Maggie. Once we arrived, though, the frantic and friendly spirit of the programme cast all gloom away. You'd have to be very churlish not to be engaged and charmed by the silliness of the show's spirit. I played a little Perudo with Chris Evans, the presenter, and did some links. I gave a showbiz tip about how to speak in cold weather without steam or vapour coming from your mouth. The technique is to suck an ice cube. They liked this very much, and for the next link, I was shown sucking some ice. I took it out of my mouth, and, you'd better believe it, lots of vapour streamed out. Very stupid, I felt. Carr took only 50 minutes to get to Maggie's in the end. Pretty good session, in fact. Probably the last this year. Maggie told me an amusing story about Margie Kinmonth, cousin of old school friend Patrick Kinmonth. This is going to be confusing, a Margie and a Maggie. I'd met Margie at Ferdy Fairfax's lunch not so long ago. Anyway, it turns out she's doing some kind of documentary with Dawn French. The purpose of this doc is to show how wonderful it is to be fat. This will help Dawn sell her collection of clothes for the larger woman, as well as pushing this idea that being overweight should not be seen as a stigma. Patrick had had a bit of a tiff with Margie about this previously. He had ventured the opinion that fatness is not wholly desirable, and that there are sound reasons why we usually find it unpleasant to behold in both others and ourselves. Margie wouldn't hear this, and trotted out all the usual fat is a feminist issue arguments. Anyway, that's by the by. Margie yesterday approached Maggie Hambling and asked if Maggie H. would allow herself to be filmed while painting Dawn as part of this fatumentary. Entry. Maggie, who is an artist and not like others, replied that A, she never allowed cameras to shoot over her shoulder while she worked, and B, she usually paints women nude, but that presumably that would be what Dawn wanted. Well, slight ums and ahs from Margie K at this. Nude? As in naked? Well, says Maggie, not deliberately trying to rootle out hypocrisy, surely the whole idea of this is that it's a celebration of flesh, and plenty of it. Great gulps of embarrassment from Margie K. Poor old Dawn. If she refuses to be painted nude with her tummy spread out like a pool of lava, she will look as if she doesn't really mean what she is saying. On the other hand, one can't really blame her for preferring to keep her clothes on, can one? I, being far less beautiful than Dawn, kept my clothes very firmly on, and we spent a merry 4 hours together. At 1 o'clock, a car came containing Rebecca Salt to take me off on a signing tour around town. What a week! First port of call was Waterston's in the Charing Cross Road. Good queue, not too many mad people, fairly amiable. Then across the road to Books, etc., for an informal stock signing. Round to Hatchard's in Piccadilly for more stock signing. Paperweight is actually number one of all sellers in Hatchard's at the moment, which is rather pleasing. Afterwards, we went off to the Strand. There was a shop there to sign at round about the 5 o'clock mark. It being 4 o'clock, Rebecca and Lynn Drew from Mandarin, who had joined us, suggested we pop into the Waldorf for tea. They'd booked a table, knowing there would be this hour gap. I was secretly a bit miffed that they hadn't got the timing better, and indeed the locations. Why not Hatchard's last, so that I could just walk to the flat? Hey-ho. Curiously, the table we were shown to was for six. Ha-ha, I thinks. Plots. Is this the right table, I wondered. Well, you never know who might turn up when you have tea at the Waldorf, Rebecca said. Something definitely up, I reasoned. Sure enough, John Potter suddenly walks in, the capo di tutti capi at Reed Books, followed by Helen Fraser, head of Heinemann, and Angela, managing editor. Well, well, well. It was very sweet. They wanted to feast me for sales of the Lyre passing the 500,000 mark. I was very touched, but then Sister Jo walks in too. Quite wonderful and V-touching. They presented me with a leather-bound, gold-tooled, head-and-tail-banded edition of the Lyre. Very sweet. Nearly cried. Gorged on tea and cakes, and then Joe and I cabbed it to the flat, just in time to change and bath for the walk to Northumberland Street, where the Perudo tournament was taking place. Hugh arrived at 7, and off we trotted. The Royal Commonwealth Hall, or Institute, or some such, was the venue. It slowly filled up with all the usual suspects. Plenty of the cool and splendid crowd. Actually, mostly sweet. It was, in fact, round about 8:30 before I could get to the microphone and address the company in the guise of the Games Master. Fairly complicated tournament rules, but everyone playing with great spirit and dash and splendour. I was at a table with Peter Cook and Carla Powell and Alice Faye and, hurrah, Jethro, Spike and Joe and Hugh. Hugh was busy cutting his commercial in his head and went fairly soon. We played informally as we had a bye into the next round. After nearly 2.5 hours, half the teams had lost, and I was able to announce the pairings for the next round. But by this time it was 11:30, and frankly time to leave with Peter and Lynn Cook and Alice Faye and Thomas and David Wilkinson and others for Peter's birthday party dinner, which was in Gran Paradiso, Pimlico. Actually, a hell of a shame to have to leave. I would much rather have stayed. I scored a couple of grams from Jethro and B, and would have happily remained. Not to be, however. The Cook party was fine. Alice Faye and I talked a bit about J. Cleese, a subject I can never tire of, him being such a comic hero and all. He had not come because he'd just completed a day's filming with Robert De Niro at Shepperton and felt he'd done badly. "Ken was disappointed in me," was his verdict. I tried to explain to AF that this was unlikely. Left at 1:15 and bed after the crossword. Phew, it's been a strange old time, from the big breakfast to the big tea to the big dinner. Non-stop since the sleeper to Dundee, really. Thursday, 18th of November, 1993. Not quite such a frantic day. Stayed in most of the morning, Hugh still editing his commercial. At 12:15, Mother popped round to take me out to Fortnum's for lunch. She's doing something in the House of Commons at 1:45, something to do with Harriet Harman and a women's thing. Never quite got to the bottom of it. The state opening today, so traffic in London ghastly. We had a very pleasant lunch, and I put her in a cab at 1:30. Back to the flat. Hugh not able to come round because of editing and so forth. I rang Christie's because I had heard that a couple of Oscar Wilde letters were coming up for auction. Put in a bid of 5,000 for the first and 15 for the second. Couldn't turn up for the sale itself. Stayed in till 6 and decided to pop round to the Groucho to see if there would be any poker. Keith Allen and Simon Bell were present, so I sat and drank with them for a while, joined by Jim Moyer, Vic Reeves, and a couple of others. At 8 o'clock, Keith, Liam, Simon and I went up to play. Keith's agent, known as T, kibitzed happily. I won a fair bit. We all ingested a goodly quantity of white powder, and I stayed sensible enough to bed myself at 1 o'clock. Friday, 19th of November, 1993. Car at 7 to take me to Shepperton. Hugh and I had agreed to film a Labour Party political broadcast. We play a couple of shady tax advisers, Weaver and Dodge, who advise a procession of fat cats how to avoid tax. There was Roger Brierley, Glossop in the first two Jeeves and Woosters, Robin Bailey, Jeremy Childs and Tim West. The idea was to demonstrate that Tory tax loopholes for the rich could save billions for the Exchequer. At lunchtime, Robin Bailey, who hadn't shot yet, was in a foully cantankerous temper. A cuntankerous cuntmudgeon, in fact, ordering the producer's assistant and first AD around as if they were skivvies. Hugh took against this hugely and was, rightly, rather curt when Bailey tried to communicate with him. Bailey, extremely sensitive to this and not pleased at all. He's barely sane at the moment, and the whole thing was somewhat embarrassing. At last he went. By this time it was apparent that we would be shooting until late. Joe and Hugh had invited Greg, Kim and Alistair round for dinner, and Hugh felt put upon simply because he hadn't been warned that shooting would take so long. If the Labour Party is inefficient as this when it comes to running the country, we're all for the basket, as Georgette Hare characters would say. At 3 in the afternoon, I learnt that my bid had been successful for the Oscar letters. Asked to remain anonymous. 4,000 for the first, 13 for the second. All told, a total of 18,700 with commish. Gulp. The filming dragged on and on. Jeremy Child, charming fellow, seems to be the absolute archetype of an Etonian baronet, which he is, but clearly, by volunteering for this gig, he does not vote along with most of his class. He told an amusing Jimbo Villas story. Footnote, the magnificent James Villiers. In the 1960s, he was apparently 20-somethingth in line of succession. John Osborne was said to have produced a typed list of the 19 from the Queen downwards who came between Villiers and the throne. He had this list mimeographed and distributed to friends. "If you meet anyone on it," he ordered, "kill them, and before we know it, Jimbo will be king, and it will be gin and tonics for everyone forever." End footnote. Jimbo had been talking about Simon Williams, who had been having a ghastly time in a play and filming and visiting his mother, since died in hospital, driving about 400 miles a day. "I hope he isn't energizing himself with the ingestion of some kind of comical pastel," Jimbo said. Splendid phrase. The time wore on and on. Eventually, we were released by 11 p.m. Hugh, not best pleased, partly brought on by the knowledge that he had made himself look grouchy. 20 people now hate me," he said. "Oh dear, made me feel guilty for being by and large cheerful all day. Of course nobody hates Hugh. Can't be done." Got to Tufnell Park, where Kim, Al and M.U., footnote, made up to protect identity, end footnote, were there, and Joe. We stayed about an hour, and then M.U. took us in his car to my place, where we stayed up drinking and coking till 5:15. Naughty. Saturday the 20th of November, 1993. Up at 1:15, slightly hungover and feeling like a piece of shit. Just time to do one or two things before making it over to the Coliseum to join Kim and Al for the first night of Lohengrin by the ENO. Footnote, English National Opera Company, resident at the Coliseum Theatre when not on tour with their English-language productions of the great opera repertoire. End footnote. Kim and Al had borne up splendidly after the ravages of the night. The show itself was excellent, not up to the Meistersingers at the ROH, but still excellent. Fascinating design by Hildegard Bechtler. Worked especially well in the first act. Slight embarrassment in the third, when the front white curtain wouldn't fly out and they had to stop. Audience naturally laughed and sniggered. Still, fine night and excellent performances. Very cute young man played Gottfried, or Godfrey, as they rather oddly called him. Still don't really go for the translations. Supper afterwards at Two Bridges Place, which was very pleasanty. Had sausages and fried camembert in front of the fire, and Rod, owner with Alfredo, gave me a form to become a member, since, embarrassingly, I've never actually belonged. Bed at midnight, and a long, 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 long sleep. Sunday the 21st of November, 1993. A very, very quiet Sunday, as placido a domingo as you could wish. Up round about one-ish, lots and lots of correspondence to sort out, and plenty of television to watch. Retired early, well, 12, and gazed at the parallax view in bed, part of BBC Two's It Was 30 Years Ago Today, Kennedy celebrations. Not sure celebrations is the word, memorial. Oddly, C.S. Lewis died on the same day, but naturally his death was somewhat overshadowed. Interesting idea for a TV play or story. Someone whose death or achievement or whatever is completely cast in the shade by a massive, earth-shattering world event. Monday the 22nd of November, 1993. Voiceover this morning, some training film with Griff as a manager. Only took 15 minutes, and then I taxied myself to South Kensington to pick up the Oscar letters. Maria Len, the leading books and autographs popsy, was very friendly, as well she might be after being written a cheque for 18,997 bleeding quid. She also showed me Henry Blofeld's collection of P.G. Wodehouse firsts and unusuals. Simply wonderful, simply, simply wonderful. But rather terrifying. They're going to be sold singly rather than as a lot, which is a bore, since some of them will go for rather an amount, I fancy. Poor old love has come unstuck as a result of Lloyd's, I gather. Footnote, Lloyd's, the insurance organisation, had suffered catastrophic losses, which were passed on to the names who subscribed to various underwriting benches in their jargon. Henry Blofeld, the cricket commentator, brother of the man after whom Ian Fleming named his most infamous Bond villain, sadly came out a loser. End of footnote. A lot of names must be selling stuff, good for people like me and for Christie's and Sotheby's. Back in time to do some writing with Hugh, and then at 3:30 off to Cambridge for a dinner. Paul Hartle's idea, this. Paul was a young don at St. Catherine's when I was at Cambridge. He's now Director of Studies in English there. Me, Nigel Huckstep, old chum from Cambridge, but a few generations older, Rob Wyke, ditto, currently housemaster at Winchester, Emma Thompson, Annabel Arden, and Simon McBurney. Footnote, Simon is the much-praised founder and leading light of Théâtre de Complicité, a hugely successful company that has won more awards than any other of its kind all over the world. Annabel now mostly directs opera, but collaborated many times with Simon McBee. End of footnote. We all gathered to reminisce and eat a good dinner in a private room in Katz. Partly to celebrate the fact that Annabel is spending this year as Judith E. Wilson Fellow at Katz. What a Judith E. Wilson Fellow is, I never quite understood, but she teaches and lectures and seems to be enjoying herself enormously. Anyway, wonderful dinner, lots of wine and drink in quantities that only academics know. Glenn Cavaliero showed up in Paul's rooms for the pre-prandials. Footnote. Adorable old-fashioned English don at Cambridge. Great expert on those marvellous Powys siblings, John Cooper, Llewellyn, Philippa and T.F. End footnote. Everyone cheery and in good form. Emma wearing her severely anti-glam Posy Simmons round spectacles. Got highly squiffed and fell into bed in Paul's rooms at 1:30. Tomorrow I have to do this camp Christmas thingy. Yuck. Tuesday, 23rd of November, 1993. Up at 9:30, a little hungover. Then I struggled over to Queen's to pop into an undergraduate's room for coffee. She had written disconsolately that I had done the Cambridge Union debate, but failed to do something or other for BATS that she had asked me to turn up for. Footnote. BATS is the Queen's College Drama Club. End footnote. She and a knot of fresher friends stood around goggling at me while I tried to be cheerful and fun. Odd occasion, so squeaky clean and non-smoking and bright-eyed and lecture-attending. Escaped at 10:30 and headed for London. Was back by midday where Hugh awaited. We wrote for most of the day and then I cabbed it to LWT, or the London Studios, as the place now calls itself, for this Camp Christmas. Oh dear. Oh dear, oh dear, oh dear. Horrid idea. Why did I ever consent? Had to dress up as Santa and make up all my own lines without rehearsal. Ghastly and under-rehearsed. Absolutely hopeless. Julian Clary, sensibly an off-stage voice. Everyone connected with it was gay. Leah Delaria was excellent doing her dyke act, but otherwise it was grim. Good Australian doing a Queen's speech. Quentin Crisp filmed in New York. Martina Navratilova phoned in to say hi. Simon Callow and Anthony Scher did something strange. And then, at the end, I came on being dreadful, completely hidden in a beard so no one knew who the hell I was anyway. Lost steam and was simply very, very bad. Christ, how embarrassing. Zoomed straight off to the Groucho to recover. Bumped into Tim Roth, of all people. Very fun to see him. He's over here filming something for the Beeb. Hung around chatting with him and his new wife. Don Boyd and Hillary turned up with Rufus Sewell, and I was able to congratulate him on his excellent performance in Arcadia. Seemed a nice bloke, freakily handsome. Played some Perudo and escaped by 1:30. A highly drunken young man in a covert coat kept sitting too close to me. Turns out he's the editor of the Sunday Times magazine or some such. Also, the director, Roger Pumphrey, kept trying to score coke off me, which I find discomforting. Relief to escape. On the way out, Greg from Channel 4, can't think of his surname, told me that I had really opened a can of worms by writing in The Spectator and then saying on Clive Anderson that there were two gay men in the cabinet. John Juner had written an article in the Mail on Sunday saying, why didn't I have the guts to name them? This ignored the thrust of my argument, which was not to accuse them of a crime, but to accuse them of hypocrisy in their insistence on telling us how to live core value back to basics lives. And in The Standard, someone had written an article pointing out that Rory Bremner had done a sketch, which had himself as John Major saying,
Portillo, Lily, don't think I can't see what you're doing at the back there.
Footnote. Peter Lilly turned out not to be gay at all, for the record. End footnote. On my return to the flat, I wrote a note to Sir John Junior, but probably won't post it. No point, really. Wednesday, the 24th of November, 1993. A day of quiet achievement. Oh, bloody ho. Started with a voiceover for Intel processors. Stopped off at Fortnum's to buy Sister Jo her birthday present for the day after tomorrow. Then round to Berry Bros and Rudd to order wine for Christmas. Simon Berry was in, and I had a nice chat with him. Ordered some excellent stuff. Back at the flat by lunchtime. Hugh was late, had a press screening of his series All or Nothing at All. He was charismatic as ever, but I didn't especially like the script. One day Hugh will find the right material and emerge either as James Bond or something that will make him a world star. He has that star quality that I so noticeably lack. I just hope that people won't think I'm jealous when the day comes. Back to the flat at 4:30, in time only for an hour or so's writing, and then he puddled off. He had time, however, to speak to me and to Man as Besto Chummo about Bachelors Anonymous. He put it to me as delicately as he could. "Stephen," he said, "are you sure you want to have anything to do with it?" No sooner were the words out of his mouth, my God, he is wise, that one, than I knew he was right. Secretly, inside, haven't even confided in you, Daisy Diary dear, I have felt that A, the script is absolute unrescuable tosh, and B, Robin Hardy is not a man I can spend months and months with comfortably. Hugh pointed out that I was too modest or too flattered to realise that he had asked me to direct the movie simply because that put him in a position to be able to raise money for it. I should be aware of that and proceed only if it was the right project, not simply out of gratitude to a nice man who wanted me involved. Heart-rending conversation with Lowe, who was wonderful, and promised to ring him and pull me out. She rang back an hour later to say that she had succeeded, but that he was deeply distressed and angry. Gulp. So much easier to apply the surgeon's knife at the inception of these projects. Why am I such an arse? Hugh said, if you want to direct a film, then write one yourself. Let it be as personal and as wonderful as you want it to be. If it's halfway decent an idea, money can be raised. Be aware that your name does mean something. This has inspired me to be careful of other people's projects. About bloody time, Stephen. Hugh popped off at 5:30, and I messed around till 8-ish, driving my own cab to Battersea, Wandsworth, Clapham, where Ian Hislop and his wife Victoria live. Quiet dinner à trois. Strangely and comfortingly bourgeois house, rather like Dan Patterson's. Modish stenciled wallpaper and perhaps over-tidy faux antique chairs. No books that I could see, or any life or mess or splendour. Odd compared to Ian's thrillingly disorganised private eye office, especially given how literary both Ian and Tori are, but a delightful dinner. I think Ian is all right, not untrustworthy. I think he knows the difference between a private dinner and usable gossip. For some reason I shot my mouth off about knowing Tristan Garrell Jones and talking to him about the age of consent and meeting Ken Clark and all that. Hope he doesn't publish or I'll feel an arse. Back home by about 12-ish. Crosswords and coke, then bed. Idiot. Thursday, the 25th of November, 1993. Just a plain old writing day. Hugh round at the usual hour, and then a lot of chat, hysterical laughter, and trying to get sketches out. In the evening, went off to the Groucho and played poker. Won a heap, snorted a heap. Also present, Rory McGrath, Griff, Keith Allen, all the usual suspects. Bed at 3, twice damned villain. Watched the recordings of the Labour Party broadcast, which had gone out at 9 and 10. Seemed okay in my haze. Friday, 26th of November, 1993. Hugh and I did a spot of work before zipping over to Holland Park for lunch with David Liddiment at the new Joe Allen Also restaurant, Orsino's. Liddiment is the man who's replaced Jim Moyer as head of light entertainment at the BBC. Footnote, not to be confused with Jim Moyer, a.k.a. Vic Reeves. This Jim Moyer is a BBC executive. End of footnote. David Liddiment turned out to be tall, thin, with glasses, a Mancunian accent, seemed wildly unfriendly at first glance, turned out to be shyness, rather a decent sort, really. Good that we touched base with him, I think. Decent grub. Back home for me, and off to the dubbing studio for Hugh. More work on his Cellnet commersh. At 7:30, I walked over to the Paris studios to record a couple of Just a Minutes. Think they went all right. I was against Peter Jones and Paul Merton. The first one had Pete McCarthy as a guest. Footnote, comedian and writer, sadly taken from the world by cancer in 2004. The second had Jan Ravens. Footnote, fellow Canterbridgian. She directed our 1981 Footlights show, The Sellotapes, voiced for Spitting Image and starred in Dead Ringers. End of footnote. Jan excelled at her silly voices and impressions. Merton and Jones were splendid as ever. I, my usual self, I suppose. In any case, I won both games, for what little that is worth. Then I had to walk very fast indeed to Le Caprice for dinner with the Cleeses, Marilyn Lowndes, footnote, better known as Marilyn Coles, the first ever fully nude Playboy centrefold, highly intelligent and deeply charming. She married Victor Lowndes, the American boss of Playboy UK. End of footnote. Also present were the Lorries and Bill Goldman. I had said I would be through recording by about 8:30. It was actually 9:45 by the time I got there. Still, everyone on good form and enjoying the chance to use me as a friendly butt. Bill Goldman, as ever, spilling over with rich advice on how to proceed with the film business. I wish I had his huevos. Chucked it in at about 12-ish. Ended on a sour note, though. There was a cluster of paparazzi outside the restaurant. Hugh did the sensible thing and zoomed out through the kitchens. I went ahead on my own and left John C. to do the same. Saturday, 27th of November, 1993. Stayed in cheerfully most of the day, emerging at 7 to Cabot to Hammersmith. Ben Elton on at the Apollo. Saw him backstage first. Phil McIntyre, footnote, Ben's long-term manager, still in post, end footnote, very sweetly had arranged a free bar backstage. Lots of darlings present, Em and Ken, Hugh, Aid and Jenny, Bob Mortimer, Rick Mayle, all sorts. Ben on stunning form. Christ, those arseholes in the press who go on about him as if he is the quintessence of modern PC evil. They haven't the faintest idea, they really haven't. If it weren't enough that he is the gentlest, kindest poppet in the world, he is also so much funnier and cleverer than they realise. The party afterwards was just absurd. Too much vody for the undersigned. And a whole deal too much of the old Brazilian marching powder, too. X, at one point, wanted a line, so I chopped him one in the loo. Y, fully on the stuff, too. I left at 2, and the joint was still jumping. Sunday, 28th of November, 1993. Sunday papers and coffee. Norman Fowler is consulting his lawyers after the Labour Party broadcast had suggested that he had gone from privatising National Freight to being on the board of the new company. They never mentioned that 9 years passed between the two acts, he perhaps rather justifiably complained. Oh dear, oh dear, oh dear. I feel a bit sorry about this, as he's one of the few of that generation of Thatcher's cabinet I really admire. The AIDS epidemic landed in his lap when he was health secretary, and since retiring he has continued to work and proselytise in the sector when he has no reason to other than moral decency. To the Cleeses, for Alice Faye's son's wedding. A lot of the Nile holiday crowd were there. Peter Cook, Bill Goldman, Ian and Mo Johnston, Thomas Starzewski, etc., etc. Wedding went all right. Rather chilly in the garden grotto. Good food and wine, and afterwards I made a small speech, as requested by Alice Fay. Then a few rounds of Perudo with Peter Cook, Thomas, Martin and Brian King. I skipped at 3-ish, having arranged that Bill Goldman would come round at 8 to examine my computer. This he duly did. He's just bought a Mac and wanted to know how they worked. Not what you would call technophile, Bill, but he gasped and wowed appropriately when shown what a Mac can do. Then we trotted off to Le Caprice again for dins. I still have to rub my eyes and pinch myself to believe that I know the man who wrote Butch Cassidy and Marathon Man and who inspired me so much with Adventures in the Screen Trade. Monday, the 29th of November, 1993. A day working with Hugh, rather thrown off course by Emma Thompson arriving at 12 to have her script rescued. She had been writing her screenplay of Sense and Sensibility on a Mac using Final Draft. Somehow it had all got corrupted. They saved it all, but lost the formatting and so on. I managed to get it all back in shape for her, but the defragging and so forth took a very, very long time. She's rather keen for Hugh to play Colonel Brandon, and equally keen, so far as I can see, for me to play no one at all. Hey-ho, quite right, no doubt. Off to Chris Beetle's gallery at 6. They were holding some kind of party and sale of illustrations on behalf of the NSPCC. All the usual suspects present, Cleese, Terry Jones, Terry Gilliam, Lord Archer, Frank Thornton. All right, he's not really a usual suspect. Footnote, Frank Thornton played the immortal Captain Peacock in Are You Being Served, of course. End of footnote. And many others present. Stayed for a while, signing T-shirts, before the Terrys persuaded me out for a bite to eat. We decided on Groucho's. Got very blasted on a lot of wine. The Terrys left, and then I stayed behind, getting even drunker with Griff and Helen Mirren. Home at 1. Tuesday, 30th of November, 1993. An exciting day. I knew it would be my first evening in for ages. Galleys of the Hippo arrived. I hate the typeface they have chosen. What can I do? It's a Palatino, the most annoying feature being really irritating inverted commas. Not curly, but naffly straight and horrid. In fact, the typeface I'm using as I write this is much better. Theirs is stark and clunky and just plain foul. Bollocks. Hugh and I didn't manage to write much. We watched The Budget instead and started reading Emma's screenplay, which I had printed out for Hugh at her request. She's actually done a smashing job. It really reads well. I was in floods of tears, absolutely loving it. Such a great story, of course. Hugh would be excellent as Brandon, but top marks to Emma, really brilliant work. The cunt of it is that she's right. There is absolutely nothing in it for me. Boo-hoo. Could make Hugh a star, which he thoroughly deserves. Footnote. Alan Rickman was cast as Colonel Brandon, and Hugh made do, hilariously, with Mr. Palmer. End of footnote. But yours truly is going to be a bit of a stay-at-home naffness while Hugh jets off to Hollywood as Mr. Big. I have always known that this will happen, but what will come hard will be everyone's sympathy for me. Bed, reasonably early, and totally sober. End of month, Daisy. Time for a printout. And there, for good or ill, that passage of the diary comes to an abrupt end. At least it doesn't, but I seem to have lost the rest of it for the time being. Perhaps it is best to have offered you that excerpt and leave the rest to be published when extricated from corrupted hard drives and no longer readable zip and jazz drives and floppy disks after my death. No need then to protect the identities or habits of those I have protected here. I have to be honest and say that reading the preceding pages gave me quite a turn. I have felt rather like someone groping forward barefoot in an unlit attic, forever treading on unexpected Lego bricks. Only 21 years have passed, but I feel as though I am peering into a wholly different world. I had no idea I was quite so busy, quite so debauched, quite so energetic, quite so irremediably foolish. To live that life, and each day so studiously to record it, is something I do not even recall doing. I cannot even be certain who I was then. If I went back into the Groucho Club of 1993 and watched myself playing a game of snooker and disappearing every 10 minutes to the gents, I'm not sure I would be able to hold back from massacring myself. How I managed to do so much working and so much playing without keeling over stone dead, I cannot imagine. Believe me when I say, if you are younger than me, that you will not make it if you think you can imitate my wicked, wicked ways. Hold fast to the belief that I am a genetic freak who survived, and that you are not. Do not test this assertion. Verb sap, as my old Latin master used to tell me, not that I listened. Verbum sapienti sat est. A word to the wise will do. I have a very clear black-and-white memory of Michael Ramsay, Archbishop of Canterbury during my childhood, being sycophantically interviewed on a BBC Sunday night programme. "Your Grace, you are considered, I believe, by those who know you, to be very wise." "Am I? Am I? Oh, my goodness, I wonder if that is true. Well, perhaps you can tell us what you think wisdom is." "Wisdom? Wisdom? Well, now, I think perhaps wisdom is the ability to cope, don't you?" I've never heard a better definition of wisdom since. Certainly wisdom is nothing to do with knowledge or intellectual force. There are brilliant minds who can't sit the right way on a lavatory, and wholly uneducated people whose fortitude and humour in coping with lives that we would find unendurable shames us all. The opposite of wisdom is generally considered to be folly, not a word much in use today. There are different kinds of fool, of course. I fooled for a living in comedy shows on television, stage and radio. I became something of a licensed fool in palaces and private houses. I was a fool to my body, most especially to my brain and the linings of my nostrils, almost daring them to wave the white flag of surrender. I often lie awake now, not for the old reason, not because my bloodstream is filled with that noxious, insinuating, and wickedly compulsive stimulant, but because my mind is churning around and around, wondering how, as a young man, I could ever have got myself into such a state. Where might my life have led me if I had not all but thrown away the prime of it as I parted like one determined to test its limits? I do not remember that an unconscious, whispered command to self-destruct drove me on, but looking back across the decades, reading the diary for the first time in 20 years, shaking my head in wonder at the reckless, impulsive, stupid, vain, arrogant, and narcissistic headlong rush into oblivion that I seemed determined upon, I have to believe that a death wish was some part of the story. And what possible excuse could I have to throw away the abundance of good fortune that at the time I could not believe I had lucked into, and which today I still find unbelievable? Maybe that is where the answer lies. It is such gimcrack armchair psychology that it may make you groan in dismay, but it is possible that I did not think myself worthy of that incredible luck, and did all I could to dispose of it. Which takes me back to the world of my first book of memoirs, Moab is My Washpot, where I describe what I must hope and trust is a common feeling amongst many children, that of being watched and judged. When our race was young, all humans felt it, and called it God. Now, most of us call it conscience, guilt, shame, self-disgust, low self-esteem, moral awareness. There are plenty of words and phrases that dance around the rim of that boiling psychic volcano. This very shame might paradoxically explain my bravado, in the way that the defenders of a crass, brash boor might explain that their friend acts in the way he does because he is so terribly shy. It wasn't difficult for me to come out as gay, or later to be open about being afflicted with a mental condition that has led to attempts at suicide. I continue to this day unthinkingly to blurt out things which will get me slammed in the tabloids and cause embarrassment to my friends and family. A part of me truly believes that honesty is, as schoolteachers used to say, the best policy in every way. It saves being found out. But it also, if this doesn't sound too self-regarding and sanctimonious, helps those who are in less of a position to feel comfortable about who they are or the situation they find themselves in. Without diverting ourselves about the nature of altruism and whether it really exists, I know that I write more or less the books that I wish I could have read when I was, between 14 and 30, I suppose. Memoir, the act of literary remembering, for me, seems to take the form of a kind of dialogue with my former self. What are you doing? Why are you behaving like that? Who do you think you're fooling? Stop it. Don't do that. Look out! Books, too, can take the form of a dialogue. I flatter myself, vainly perhaps, that I've been having a dialogue with you. You might think this madness. I'm delivering a monologue, and you are either paying attention or wearily scrolling through until you reach the end. But truly, I do hear what I consider to be the voice of the listener. Your voice. Yes, yours. Hundreds of thousands of you, wincing, pursing your lips, laughing here, hissing there, nodding, tutting, comparing your life to mine with as much objective honesty as you can. The chances are that you have not been as lucky with the material things in life as I have. But the chances are, and you may find this hard to believe, but I beg that you would, that you are happier, more adjusted, and simply a better person. If there's one thing that most irks my most loyal and regular readers, it is the spectacle of me beating myself up in public. I try to fight it, but it is part of who I am. I am still a fool, but I have greater faith in the healing force of time. It is possible that age brings wisdom. The spectacle of many of our politicians and other citizens of middle age and beyond gives one leave to doubt that hope. There is a fine legend concerning King Solomon, the wisest of all the kings of Israel. You may know the story in another way. It hardly matters. It is a good story and worth remembering. King Solomon was being visited by a great Persian king. During their conversation, the Persian king said, "You have much wealth and power and wisdom here, Solomon. I wonder if you have heard of the magical golden ring." "Of which ring?" "They say that if you are happy, it will make you sad, but if you are sad, it will make you happy." Solomon thought for a second before clapping his hands for an attendant. He whispered into the attendant's ear. The attendant disappeared with a bow, and the king clapped his hands again and called for dates and sherbets. After the dates and sherbets had been consumed, it was not long before the attendant had returned, bringing with him a goldsmith in a leather apron. The goldsmith bowed before both the kings and passed to Solomon a golden ring. Solomon turned to his visitor. "I have the ring that will make you happy if you are sad, and sad if you are happy." "But that is not possible," cried his guest. "The ring is a legend. It is not something you can command to have made in the twinkling of an eye." "Read it," said Solomon. The visiting king took the ring, still warm from the forge, and read upon it the words, "This too shall pass." If days be good, they shall pass, which is a lowering thought. If they be bad, they shall pass, which is cheering. I suppose it is enough to know this and cling on to it for some small comfort when confronted by the irredeemable and senseless folly of the world, to be a little like Raphael Sabatini's Scaramouche, who was born with a gift of laughter and a sense that the world was mad. But I know enough of myself and the instability that seems to be my birthright to be sure that I have not yet learned this lesson. More fool me. Post-ars. Since there is no preface, there must be a post-ars. I have many people to thank. Literary parturition can be as messy and bloody a business as the obstetric kind. This book would not have been possible without all those who expend so much thought and energy clearing the thicket of my engagements and commitments in order to give me enough time to write. They include, but are not limited to, my writing agent, Anthony Goff, and my dramatic agent, Christian Hodell. Most especially, of course, I owe everything to the book's dedicatee, my patient, efficient, kind, and wonderful personal assister, Joe. Everyone at Penguin Books has been sublimely professional, useful, wise, understanding, and fun. Above all, my epically perfect editor, Louise Moore, and her stellar team, Hannah Osman, Katya Shipster, Roy McMillan, and so many others. Once again, David Johnson has taken on the task of organizing the author tour events, cinema streamings, and those other oddities that constitute a book launch in the 21st century. His skill and experience have made that sluttish side of selling so much more enjoyable than it would otherwise have been. Thanks to everyone mentioned in this book. Some of you have read the manuscript and kindly corrected my memory. Others have used the search facility to jump from one mention of their name to the next and then signed off. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. This audiobook was produced and published by Penguin Books Limited. Recording copyright 2014.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program.